recent years, government has largely ignored, discounted, or put environmental causes on the back burner, leading some people to feel that it was up to them to pick up the slack and demonstrate how we can all make a difference in an effort to save the planet. Edward Humes, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and editor-at-large for Los Angeles Magazine, joins me now to discuss his new book about the so-called eco-barons, which is published by HarperCollins. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Did you coin the term eco-barons?
I think it's been kicking around for a while, but I'm using it in a new way to describe people I see as the opposite of the old robber barons. You know, robber barons for good, so to speak.
Well, some of the robber barons did for good and for bad all at the same time, like Andrew Carnegie, who polluted the atmosphere, took advantage of his workers, but also gave us public libraries.
True,
and hospitals.
There was certainly philanthropy connected to the robber barons, but there was also a certain laying waste to the landscape and depletion of resources and so forth. And the folks that I'm looking at as eco barons are really healing the landscape, conserving.
Do they know each other?
There are some connections. For instance, one of the main characters in the book, Doug Tompkins, who was the founder and CEO of Esprit and the North Face, and who now is engaged in preserving large portions of the South American rainforest, he has a foundation that gives grants to environmental groups he thinks are worthy. And one of his grantees, the Center for Biological Diversity, is another character, if you will, in the book. So there's some connections between these folks, but they're mostly operating separately.
What came first for Doug Tompkins, his concerns about the environment or his creation of North Face, which, of course, deals with the environment?
Well, his love as a young man was mountain climbing, and so he says that he was always most comfortable out in nature. You know, this is a guy that likes to be sleeping on a ledge 8,000 feet up, getting ready to make the final ascent. That's where he's happiest. And the North Face was an outgrowth of that. But then when he sold that and he and his wife started Esprit, he threw himself, driven man that he is, into building this empire of image and fashion. And he was very successful at it, but not really feeling like he was doing what he needed or wanted to do.
Hasn't most of his work been in Chile?
It started when he was still at Esprit. You could see his movement away from the business world and towards the environmental world while he's still at the company, because against his stockholders and board's wishes, he insisted on this buy what you need campaign. He'd literally put tags on the fashions he was selling and say, do you really need to buy this? Only buy it if you need it. You know, and it was quite successful, as it happens, counterintuitively. But it was one of his steps away from this consumer consciousness that he has in later life come to decry.
Mm-hmm. But you said he's involved with rainforests. There are plenty of problems right here in the United States. Why has he chosen to work in other countries?
One of his seminal mountain climbing experiences was on Mount Fitzroy, which he made a first ascent on a new route with Yvon Chouinard, who would go on to found the company Patagonia, and several other climbers. And he really fell in love with this part of the world. And it was also a place where there was a great deal of land that could be purchased in quantity at a bargain price when he began doing this in the early 90s. And he felt he could get more bang for his buck there, that there was this irreplaceable landscape that would soon be disappearing. He's made sure it doesn't disappear.
And that, I guess, is the concern of all these people, that they want to get a big bang for their buck. Are they succeeding?
I'd say they are. And let me say, though, that as I define this idea of eco-barons, it's really not measured by their bank accounts, because there's among them are people who have relatively little financial resources. It's really a measurement of their impact on the environment. But there are people like Doug Tompkins and his wife, Chris, who was formerly the CEO of Patagonia, who the two of them together have preserved more rainforest than any individuals on the planet. There's Roxanne Quimby, also very well off from her creation and then later sale of the Burt's Bees personal care item company, and she's doing great work preserving land in Maine in the last great eastern forest. So, yeah, they are having, in some cases, a very game-changing impact, I think.
My guest is Edward Humes, and his book is I Say Eco, He Says Echo. Let's call the whole thing off. Eco Barons, the Dreamers, Schemers, and Millionaires Who Are Saving Our Planet. It is published, interestingly, by Echo, E-C-C-O, and which is a division of HarperCollins. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Why haven't we heard more about these people and their efforts? Are they seeking credit for what they do?
I'd say for the most part, no. What's interesting about what they're engaged in, to me, is the fact that they are not throwing up their hands and saying the problems are too big, which is, for most of us, kind of paralyzing. They're just going out and doing it. They're not necessarily publicizing themselves. Doug Tompkins was actually vilified for quite a number of years in Chile. People were very suspicious of this idea of a foreigner coming in, buying up land, and not exploiting it and trying to give it away, give it to the government, give it to nonprofits. It was a very difficult concept for people to accept without believing there was an ulterior motive.
Didn't the Chilean government call him an eco-terrorist?
Oh, well, there was rumors abounded about what he might really be up to. He was a CIA spy. He was trying to start a second Israel, a new homeland for the Jewish people. Yes, eco-terrorist was one of the things that was floated.
And this is post-Pinochet. This is the new democratic government of Chile.
Yes. What happened was Pinochet's cronies had bought up all this land in Patagonia because he had promised to develop it. He was going to build this immense highway, and there was lavish promises about what was to come. When the old dictator finally left office and those plans fell away, the land went up for sale for a song. And in swoops, Doug Tompkins with a great big checkbook and this crazy idea of not developing but saving the land.
You would think that publicity would actually be a positive thing because it would encourage others to follow their examples.
Yes, and I think to an extent that has happened. I mean, there have been news reports about the Tompkinses and about Roxanne Quimby. This organization, the Center for Biological Diversity, is a great example of the two-edged sword of this publicity phenomenon because the interesting thing about this group is their mission is to see that the Endangered Species Act and other environmental laws are actually enforced. And our country has been breaking these laws routinely, both at the government level and in the private sector, for years. So they come along and say, no, we're going to take you to court and see that the law is followed. And they are painted as the outlaws.
Tell us about the two former Forest Service owl counters turned activists.
Oh, these are amazing guys, Kieran Suckling and Peter Galvin. They were contract workers in New Mexico. This is back at towards the end of the Reagan era. And their job was to go out at night in the Gila National Forest in New Mexico and hoot like owls to see if they could detect the presence of the endangered Mexican spotted owl. And if they could detect them, then the Forest Service couldn't sell the timber and have it logged, which was a priority at that time for National Forest, not preserving them but cutting them down. If they could find the owls, then they couldn't cut them. Well, they did find the owls, and then the Forest Service went ahead and tried to cut down the trees anyway, and they decided to go public. They began taking on the role not of contractors but of activists. And had enormous success because it turns out that this then little-used Endangered Species Act was a powerful tool for preserving species and environments.
But it's interesting that pretty much every administration, not just the Reagan administration but everyone since, has been concerned about protecting logging industry interests, for example, and fighting the Endangered Species Act to varying degrees. The most recent Bush administration perhaps has had the worst record, according to environmentalists. But his father, Reagan, and then George Bush the First, Bill Clinton, none of them were really committed environmentalists.
That's true. Enforcement of the act has gone from just abysmal to, under Clinton, kind of so-so. He was certainly better than his predecessors and successor. But it's interesting to me because this the act was passed in 1973 as a completely bipartisan measure. It was unanimous in the Senate. Barry Goldwater was in the Senate then, certainly no liberal.
We had a Republican president at the time.
Nixon signed it and celebrated. He said, "This is our environmental awakening." Those are his words. How do we go from bipartisan to the Endangered Species Act as this crazy-eyed, liberal, wacky idea? I don't know, but that's, I think, has been part of the problem, has been the partisanship that has become attached to these issues didn't always exist, but it's now infected it completely.
Well, it's interesting that it's become politicized because the first really serious environmentalist president we had was a Republican,
Absolutely.
Teddy Roosevelt.
Yes.
Have we had any others other than Richard Nixon?
Well, certainly Roosevelt set the standard for a conservationist presidency, and there really hasn't been any like that. The last president that seriously put environmentalism and energy efficiency on the front burner was Jimmy Carter, you know, when he held that famous press conference on the roof of the White House and said, "Here's the solar panels. These are symbolic of what we need to do." And really, by the time he left office, America led the world in wind and solar and renewable energy, and we threw all that away in successive years.
Why do you think so many people in the conservative movement argue that global warming is a myth?
It's perplexing because the science is not equivocal. I mean, it's solid. We know what's happening.
They argue that we are going through a global cooling, and eventually it will lead to an ice age, one of the normal cycles.
Well,
on this planet.
That's not based on any science that I've seen or read about. I think what's really going on is that we've gone through 8 years of an administration that has been so hostile to science in general that it's become a kind of dogma among certain members of the conservative movement that science is not to be trusted, and climate is a big part of that.
And why do you think that is?
Well, because if you accept the reality of climate change, it means that certain things have to change in the way we live, and that government has to take a more active role in seeing that those changes occur, and that is not an easy pill to swallow for some American political figures.
Well, should America be leading the industrialized world in combating global warming?
I think just as – and this is something that many of the people I met during the course of working on EcoBurn said, that if – you know, if America – this is the country that entered and turned the tide in World War II and then rebuilt much of the world afterwards through the Marshall Plan, and then came up with this amazing GI Bill that created the middle class. I mean, we have a history of taking on these big problems and seeing them through. And climate change has to be viewed in that same context.
Well, part of the problem is that there are emerging nations who want to have special dispensation. Isn't that true? Brazil, a number of other Latin American countries, and especially China and India. Aren't they really the major contributors to global warming these days?
Yes, and the major justification for not taking definitive action is that America is not doing so. And we are not leading. We are trailing the world on this. And we're trailing it for the wrong reasons. There's this, you know, now we hear, well, the economy's terrible. Times are too tough to do anything about the environment. But of course, when times were good, it was the wrong time to do anything about the environment then, too, because, well, why should we put ourselves at a disadvantage to our global competitor? So in other words, it's never the right time to do what's right for the environment.
How much are we contributing to global warming?
Well, America and China are the two biggest contributors to global warming, and per capita, America by far. Our diet contains seven times the amount of beef that most nutritionists would say is healthy. Livestock growing has taken over 30% of the surface of the earth. It's a bigger greenhouse gas contributor than our cars are. So we are driving the climate change train here in America.
And that is not because of government policy. That's just because of the kind of demand that the American public
is
making.
Well, I think it is government policy because we're subsidizing this kind of consumption with our tax dollars. I mean, under Bush, we would give a $50,000 tax credit to people who bought Hummers. That's crazy.
Didn't the Bush administration push through some 11th-hour changes that could have an impact on the environment and that the Obama administration is saying they're going to reevaluate?
Yes, and I think they've already eliminated some of those executive orders that could be immediately turned back. One of the big midnight rule changes had to do with the Endangered Species Act, which gives primacy to science. This is the principle of the Endangered Species Act that Mr. Suckling and Mr. Galvin have exploited so thoroughly, is that economic considerations can't rule the day when extinction is on the line, because, you know, building a shopping mall or a road or a dam is great, but they come and go. Extinction is forever. So we're going to make science the rule the decision on whether a species and a habitat should be protected. And somehow, through an executive action, President Bush has sought to rewrite that law so that political and economic considerations are paramount. That is being challenged in court right now.
My guest is Edward Humes, H-U-M-E-S, author of 8 nonfiction books, including the bestseller Mississippi Mud, most recently Monkey Girl. He's received the Pulitzer Prize for his journalism and is a writer at large for Los Angeles Magazine. The latest book, Echo Barons, The Dreamers, Schemers, and Millionaires Who Are Saving Our Planet, published by Echo, ECCO. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Edward Humes. His book, Echo Barons, The Dreamers, Schemers, and Millionaires Who Are Saving Our Planet, published by Echo Press, which is a division of HarperCollins. We've been talking about some of the wealthier people who have been engaged in this, but you also write about some of us regular folks who spend time and money to make a difference, like Carol Allen, who's a widowed single mother. What did she do?
Well, Carol Allen lives in the Houston area. She works for a juvenile probation department at the county level, and she has a passion for turtles. And if you visit her house, you'll find it's filled with turtle plushes and pictures and statues. And she became distressed when she learned that sea turtles were being driven into extinction by the Gulf of Mexico shrimp industry. And so she rather single-handedly began taking on this very powerful special interest in Texas to try and get them to change their ways, because the way they trawl, the nets they use was extremely destructive. They would catch and drown and kill these sea turtles. And at first, no one was really paying her much attention, but she recruited school children to do fundraising. And pretty soon that effort spread around the country and became part of something called Project Heart. And suddenly she had this army of school children and was garnering headlines, convinced an environmental group to put undercover operatives aboard the shrimp fleet, which had denied it was harming these turtles, and recorded evidence of just wholesale slaughter. And that forced the federal government and the state government to act. And because of her very dogged efforts over a long period of time, at her own expense, as a volunteer, she saved the species from extinction.
Although the shrimp industry did fight back, didn't it?
It did. She received hate mail and death threats. The shrimpers at one point, when it looked like the government was going to act earlier on, did a blockade in the Houston port. And it was really quite an ugly confrontation. But what struck me, why I thought her story was so important, is that it's very easy to assume you need enormous resources at your disposal to be an echo baron, to have an impact. And in fact, her impact has been enormous beyond the mere protection of a single species, which was called the Kemp Ridley sea turtle. She brought about the protection of whole habitats in the coastal area of the Gulf that would never have been in place without her efforts.
Yeah, the people who fight these environmental efforts say that it will lose jobs. But can focus on green advancements actually be profitable and create jobs in this economy?
I think the evidence says yes. The Tompkins efforts in Chile and Argentina have created a new green economy there, green tourism. They have, in order to acquire the land for the parks and wildlife preserves, they've created 11 of them. They've done land swaps with local people and helped them establish sustainable agriculture and organic farming businesses, and it's been quite successful. That's at a local level in a country with a very low standard of living compared to what Americans are accustomed to. But you can see the same thing at this end, where companies like Walmart have found that this seemingly obvious idea that nobody gets is that pollution and flagrant use of energy is wasteful, and waste costs money. So if you eliminate the waste, you're not only benefiting the environment, you're helping your bottom line. That idea seems so obvious, but it's only now just catching on.
Aren't some people arguing that environmental issues are linked to national security?
Well, they have been since the oil crises of the 70s, because we saw just how dangerous it is for our economy and our security for us to be dependent upon fossil fuels that are not in our control.
So along those lines, tell us about Professor Andy Frank and his work on hybrid car technology.
Oh, yeah. I love this guy. He is the father of the hybrid car. I mean, he patented it.
In this country, Detroit has been really slow to utilizing this technology.
Well, the sad history of finding alternatives to the internal combustion engine, which is the most inefficient, dirty method of transportation ever conceived of. 80% of the gas we burn in our gas tanks doesn't move the car. It's waste. And it's an insane method of transportation. $8 out of $10 you spend on gas are wasted. So Andy Frank uses teams of college students. He's a professor at the University of California, Davis. And he can take a Ford Explorer or a Chevy Suburban and yank out its guts, put in an electric motor, a very small gas-sipping hybrid-type engine, and his car, this big behemoth, a Suburban, will get 100 miles to the gallon. If you go short trips under 60 miles round trip, you don't use any gas. So imagine a car, a Detroit car, that gets to the gas station once or twice or maybe three times a year.
That's better than the Prius or the Honda.
It's better than hybrid. The Chevy Volt. It's better than anything that Detroit is making. And Detroit has paid him to design these cars, to build prototypes, and then they hide them.
Why do you think that is?
They don't want to cannibalize what has been a profitable business for them over the years. The history of this, California forced the car makers to build zero-emission vehicles in the 90s and in year 2000. They had a mandate. If you want to sell cars in California, you better build these. And they did build them. First they sued, then they lobbied, and they whined, and they finally defeated the initiative. But before they did, they built these cars. People are still driving them. They said they could never last, and they're still driving them. They're selling them on eBay, and they love them. I've driven them. You could go 150 miles in a Toyota RAV4 EV, a little SUV, 150 miles on a single charge. And Detroit claims now they can only build one, the Chevy Volt, that can go 40 miles.
And I wonder why, and I also wonder why Detroit has been so resistant, considering the fact that if they switched over and everybody got excited about buying cars that saved gas – I realize it'll cost a bit more, but in the end, I guess it amortizes itself out. That Detroit has to only gain by it. If they come up with a better car than the Japanese have come up with, wouldn't Detroit then once again dominate the automobile market?
Well, that makes sense to me. I change is hard. Part of the problem, and it's true not just of car makers but all of us, is we only know the way we live. It's all we know, and we can't see how insanely wasteful some of the things we do are. It's habit in a lot of ways, and it's very hard to abandon what we've always done and build a different kind of car. That's not how they've made their fortunes, and it's very, very hard to change.
My guest is Edward Humes, whose latest book is Eco Barons, The Dreamers, Schemers, and Millionaires who are saving our planet. During the political campaign, John McCain and Sarah Palin and a lot of other people said that offshore drilling and opening up parts of Alaska were the way to go. The critics said this is destructive to the environment. Is it really destructive to the environment?
Yes, and it's also a kind of a bait and switch. You know, drill, baby, drill is not going to solve our problems.
My dentist says the same thing.
Well, that's different. You know? I encourage good dental hygiene. But the amount of oil that we can obtain through additional offshore drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Preserve or in other sensitive areas where there are endangered species is so minuscule that it really has no bearing at all on our energy policy. It's focusing on a very tiny thing when we have a much bigger problem. We could do much more by conserving, by having more efficient appliances, more efficient electrical grids, by bringing more renewables online. You know, to get back to Andy Frank for a second, who, with his hybrid car technology, part of his idea is small-scale solar to charge up these cars. So then you have a completely clean transportation system that also takes the pressure off our electrical generation demands. And it all fits together.
Toyota has been talking about putting solar panels in the roof of the car.
That's a cool idea. I'd have to learn more about that. But certainly there's been experimental cars that actually GM built the Sun Racer and won a world competition by doing just that right before they came out with their first and only electric car, the EV1.
Which they then scrapped.
But that was a wonderful car. Andy Frank was hired to turn that into a hybrid, which he did. And it was highly successful. That was actually what was supposed to happen with the EV1. The all-electric version was a test bed. The hybrid was the goal, but then they never brought it to market.
Can you tell us about another one of your Echo Barons, Terry Tamminen?
Terry Tamminen is a great story. He's another one of those guys you'd say, well, he's no Echo Baron. He doesn't have any great wealth. Well, he was a pool cleaner in Malibu when the story starts. And of course, Malibu, California is home to many affluent and celebrity-type clients. He got to know them, although that wasn't his path to success. Actually, he became interested in water quality through his pool work, as he explains it.
Skimming too much scum off of the pools.
I guess so. And he began working with and eventually took over as executive director the Santa Monica Baykeeper environmental organization. Basically, he'd patrol the bay and look for pollution violations and report them, kind of an environmental cop. It's related to the Riverkeeper organizations that Bobby Kennedy Jr. was involved with for many years. Well, Arnold Schwarzenegger comes along, decides he's going to be governor of California, or he's going to run for it, and he asks his in-law, Bobby Kennedy Jr., who he can talk to in California about environmental policy. And he says, well, go talk to Terry. So that's how they came together. And before long, the former Malibu pool cleaner was the architect of California's environmental policy, which includes the most far-reaching climate change legislation on the planet.
Fought by the Bush administration, although I gather there's a reevaluation of those rules as well. But do you think that in this current economic climate, Barack Obama will be able to fulfill all the campaign promises he made about the environment?
Well, you know, we'll have to wait and see. I think that
We're bailing out banks and insurance companies and maybe even automobile companies, although I'm not sure that built into that is more fuel-efficient cars.
It should, and to some extent has been tied to that. But his idea that green initiatives, sustainability, renewable energy, initiatives that are good for the environment are also going to be good for the economy makes sense. And as long as he can make that case, and I think it's a good one, I think it will be possible to put economic recovery and environmental recovery on the same page.
Don't some people argue that we've passed the tipping point on this, that global warming at this point is inevitable? We may be able to slow it down, but We've just set it into motion. We're losing so much of the ice cap, and we're losing all the ice sheets and Greenland, et cetera, et cetera. And there's no way of getting them to go back.
Well, we have committed ourselves to experience some climate change. We've already topped the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, 350 parts per million, I believe it is, in which some changes are inevitable. But there's a lot we can do to minimize it and keep it from becoming catastrophic. But we needed to act 10 years ago or 8 years ago or, you know, some more than we have done. And
I guess what I'm asking is many people have said
pointless.
To me, yeah, you know, I will try to do anything I can to reduce my carbon footprint and put in fluorescent bulbs, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm really not going to have all that much of an impact.
Well, you know, they say if we cut our beef consumption nationwide in half, it would be as if we all bought Priuses and started driving them. So there, you know, there is power in acting collectively. There is power in leading the world down a different path. And that's, you know, that's what America can do. It has done it in the past, but it really will take that level of national commitment. This is our World War II, and people still really don't get how serious our predicament is. It's not irreversible, but, you know, imagining postponing entering World War II another year or two, how would history have changed? That's where we're at with climate change now.
And that's one of the reasons you wrote this book, I assume. Well, you really hope to affect a change in policy?
Well, and it's for exactly the reason that you said, oh, I could do these things that will be helpful to the environment, but what good is it? You know, it's so big with the fossil fuel dependence and climate change and Arctic ice melting. It's paralyzing. And so the idea I had was, well, is there a way into the story that's a little more graspable and human and hopeful? And that's what these people, these echo barons, are about. And I felt much more hopeful when I was done this book than I did when I started the research.
You also come from Southern California, where I remember 30 years ago, the smog was so thick it really hurt your eyes. Now it's quite pleasant. So we can really affect change, can't we?
Well, we can. I mean, look at those of us who are old enough to remember the anti-litter campaign of the 60s and that wonderful campaign featuring Ironized Cody, the Native American who was paddling down this litter-strewn stream in his canoe. It changed the way people looked at litter. And, you know, we don't do it anymore the way it was common in the 60s. I think there are seminal moments that occur when people finally get it and they say, we're going to take a different path. And that's what we need to find now.
Edward Humes will be giving a talk tonight at 6:30 at the Public Library's Mid-Manhattan branch on Fifth Avenue. And then tomorrow he'll be at the Mulberry Street branch of the New York Public Library between Mulberry and Lafayette. That's at 6 o'clock. His book is called Echo Barons, The Dreamers, Schemers, and Millionaires Who Are Saving Our Planet. It is published by Echo, and a reminder that Mr. Humes is a Pulitzer Prize winner, author of 8 other books, and also a writer at large for Los Angeles Magazine. Thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
It's been my pleasure.